Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehr Show, live coverage of President Obama's announcement of changes to the NSA surveillance programs, the programs revealed by Edward Snowden. The announcement is scheduled for 11 o'clock. We will hear what the president is proposing as a new balance between privacy and security. We'll also get thoughts on the topic from America's only Muslim congressman, Democrat Keith Ellison of Minnesota, who happens to be here in New York today because he has a new book. Also today, dueling investigations in Bridgegate, why Christie has hired Rudy Giuliani's former chief of staff to run the governor's own investigation. Will it be used as a way to duck the independent ones? And Super Bowl security, far from the 50-yard line, the massive program to protect the players, the fans, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers in New York as well as New Jersey. Let's begin with those dueling Bridgegate investigations. 17 of Governor Christie's staffers and three organizations were issued subpoenas yesterday by the State Assembly and the State Senate, which is launching its own investigation. At the same time, Governor Christie hired Randy Mastro, a lawyer and longtime Giuliani associate, to conduct an internal review of the lane closures. WNYC's Metro editor, Andrea Bernstein, is with us. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Brian.
So we're now up to six investigations into the lane closures on the George Washington Bridge in September. Here is Governor Christie talking about these investigations in his State of the State address, suggesting cooperation, but not necessarily 100% cooperation.
We will cooperate with all appropriate inquiries to ensure that this breach of trust does not happen again.
So Christie may be signaling here that some of the inquiries might be inappropriate and that he may not cooperate. Does the appointment of his own task force to look into it set something up?
Well, Randy Mastro is known for flooding the zone as a litigator. He is both the head of the litigation unit and the crisis management unit at his law firm, which is a very well-connected law-slash-lobbying firm with offices in New York, Washington, all the important places. And so I expect that one of the things that he's going to be doing is trying to put a pause button on all of this. I mean, this has just been leaking, you know, sort of like the proverbial rats jumping off the sinking ship, with everybody seeming to flee Trenton, documents coming out in volumes. So I expect that that is part of what Randy Mastro and his law firm are there to do, is to sort of get aggressive so that it slows this whole thing down. But also, I mean, I have to say I'm really surprised that, given the fact that Christie was a former prosecutor himself, that there were many people who served as attorney general in the state of New Jersey, including David Sampson, the former chair of the Port Authority, and other people who cycled in and out of the Port Authority over the last 4 years, that they didn't have somebody internally on top of this. It's still stunning to me that after months of reporting, a governor could be blindsided by what was in the emails. I would have expected somebody with that background to have known all of this way before we did.
Well, that could be one of the most incriminating things to emerge if it turns out to be that Governor Christie did know. One of the most incriminating things to him and one of the most politically damaging. I want to play a clip of State Senate President Stephen Sweeney on this program the other day after the State of the State. Listen to what I asked him and listen to his response. Under what circumstances could you see the bridge scandal resulting in impeachment or recall?
The only way, look, if there is a direct connection, the governor had knowledge or the governor was directing it, well, then obviously that would cause that. But, Brian, we have not got there yet, but we are going to do that investigation. That investigation is going to go forward, and wherever it leads, it's going to lead.
Even knowledge of it?
If he had direct knowledge of it, yes.
so Stephen Sweeney the other day. But you were just suggesting, Andrea, that there's almost no way that he couldn't have had direct knowledge of what really went on there because so much information had been swirling. The press had been on it for weeks and weeks and weeks before the really damning emails came out the other day.
Well, what we know from the documents is that at least eight of his top aides knew very, very early on that there was an accusation by the executive director of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Now, we know they hated him. We know they called him a piece of excrement and worse.
Patrick Foy, appointed right. by Governor Cuomo.
Right. But still, he is an important person. And he said, 4 days into this, crimes have been committed. He said, state laws and federal laws have been broken. And one of the big questions is given that, what did all of these people around Chris Christie, a former federal prosecutor, do to look into that? So far, we haven't seen any evidence of that. There wasn't even an internal, an inspector general investigation at the Port Authority until Assemblyman Wisniewski had begun to hold hearings and make a lot of noise.
Of course, when you're a prosecutor, you want to know everything. When you're a chief executive, maybe you only want to know what you want to know. With both houses of the New Jersey legislature controlled by Democrats, why did it launch two investigations, one in the Assembly, one in the Senate?
Well, like so much of this, I think that's also politics, right? I mean, everybody sort of wants to be the hero now. And Assemblyman Wisniewski has been very, very aggressive, very out front. His questioning has been very deliberate. And he is, in fact, way ahead of the state Senate. But they have their own political power base to push. So we will have to see how that plays out. Matt Katz, our New Jersey reporter, has a story on our website today about just this, about how the infighting between New Jersey Democrats could potentially impede their investigation. Now, one of the things that's sort of amazing to me is that given that there is a federal prosecutor looking at this, I wonder at what point these investigations get shut down, at what point the federal prosecutor starts bigfooting it and saying, you are going to be impeding with my investigation. I'm surprised that that hasn't happened in any public way as of yet.
I think we've seen instances in Congress where people under investigation in the federal government refuse to testify before Congress, which is a political inquiry, because they say they're under investigation in a legal inquiry and therefore can't go public, right?
Right. And in fact, that's what David Wildstein did when he went before the Assembly Transportation Committee, said he took the Fifth Amendment over and over and over and over again. But he also turned over all those documents. And I guess one of the things we'll be watching in this latest batch of subpoena inquiries is whether any of the lawyers of these 20 individuals and organizations is going to argue, we're not giving you anything because of the federal criminal investigation.
He turned over those documents that included the famous time for a traffic jam in Fort Lee email because they were subpoenaed by the legislature and he didn't fight the subpoena, right?
Well, he made this last-minute attempt to quash his testimony before he went before the Assembly. But no, he didn't fight that. He turned it over. And one of the things that's very interesting to me about those documents is that if you look at the way they're laid out, they provide all kinds of tantalizing hints and clues as to what he might know about other people. He seems to be sending a signal to a federal prosecutor, David Wildstein, I'm talking about, I know more. If you let me off, I'll give you something.
Like what? What are the hints in there?
Well, for example, there is testimony before the legislature that there are several copies of it in the documents. One of the copies is all marked up with several different pieces of handwriting. It's unclear who are the people that were marking up that testimony. I think that's one of the questions. Another question is he sent this series of text messages referring to a meeting between the governor and the Port Authority chair, David Sampson. Now, we know that was responsive to the inquiry, but we don't know why.
212-433-WNYC. If you have any reaction to the latest developments in Bridgegate, the naming of these various investigating bodies yesterday, two now in the state legislature, one now being run by the governor himself, 212-433-9692, or any more of the emerging details as we speak with WNYC Metro editor Andrea Bernstein. We'll get to her reporting today that you may have heard on Morning Edition in a minute about the Port Authority being used as a political piggy bank in New Jersey. But I just want to stay on the legislature's investigation for a minute, because the New Jersey Senate appointed Senator Loretta Weinberg to lead this investigation, Democrat from Teaneck, whose district also includes Fort Lee, the first person to publicly raise the suggestion that maybe politics was at play in these lane closures. But even way before that, she's not exactly a friend of Chris Christie. Does this make it more politically motivated? Does it make it seem more politically motivated rather than a dispassionate inquiry to get to the facts than if they had put somebody else in charge?
Well, I think we'll have to see how she does it. I mean, I don't actually think there's anybody they could have chosen where that wouldn't have been an argument. I mean, Christie has been making that from the get-go, from the press conference he had in December where he was announcing Bill Baroni's resignation, where, by the way, he said, oh, he was going to leave anyway.
Another appointee to the Port Authority.
Right. And he said at the time, oh, he was going to leave anyway. He's my friend. He's done a great job. But we're just moving this up because of all the attention this is getting. But even at that time, he was very clear to say this is politically motivated. The National Democrats are after me. They're going to criticize everything that I do. So I don't think there is any way they could have picked the Pope to run the investigation in the Senate that it wouldn't have been called politically motivated.
So 17 of Governor Christie's staffers and three organizations were issued subpoenas yesterday by the State Assembly Committee doing its own investigation. Presumably, Bridget Ann Kelly, the deputy chief of staff who wrote the Time for a Traffic Jam in Fort Lee email, is one of those subpoenaed. When do you think she'll testify?
Well, there's been some reporting that Politiker New Jersey, which ironically was run by David Wildstein under the pseudonym Wally Edge for many years, reported yesterday that
that's a news organization,
right? Right. It has been bought by the New York Observer, was bought by the New York Observer. So so far as we know, it's now not politically involved. But they reported yesterday the names of a number of people that were included in those subpoenas. I don't know. I mean, the last time around, the timeline was about it was a few weeks before the documents had to be turned over, and then the testimony was almost immediate. So I would expect by early February they would have to return these documents. I mean, we're looking at huge submissions, 900 pages, 656 pages. So there has to be some time to given, some a reasonable amount of time given to respond to the subpoenas.
Who else was on that list of names that Politiker revealed? Anybody intriguing or unexpected?
I don't know, unexpected, but the governor's spokesman, which I think is going to be very interesting. There were some really interesting interchanges. One I can't get over is that he and David Wildstein were criticizing a Star Ledger reporter, calling him an effing mutt. And then David Wildstein starts to question the reporter's ethics. And he says, he's so unethical. He's just recycling a story that was in the Wall Street Journal. He doesn't have any of his own contacts. And it's just sort of crazy to me that in all of this document dump, the only mention of unethics is by a reporter that was reporting out the scandal.
It's about a reporter, yeah. Did they subpoena Christie himself?
No, not according to this tweet that I saw.
Why not? Why wouldn't they?
Oh, well, what Wisniewski has said is that he wants to go deliberately. He wants to go step by step by step and see what you can get. And, you know, I mean, this is a common tool. I mean, we do it, too, in investigative reporting. We don't go to the top person right away. We gather everything we can from everybody around so we know exactly what to ask. So that is also a investigative technique by legislative committees and prosecutors. They tend to go for the lower people, get them all lined up, and then go for the big cheese.
So then this list does not preclude subpoena himself.
No, and they've
in the
said
future.
That.
Although such a central question is, who ordered this bridge closure? It wasn't necessarily Bridget Ann Kelly just because she wrote that email. She may have been told by a higher up, and as deputy chief of staff, there aren't many people who are higher up. I guess there are two. One would be the chief of staff and the other would be the governor. So, I mean, it's not going to take many steps before they have to answer the question directly. Was Governor Christie telling the truth when he said he knew nothing about ordering the lane closures as a political payback until it was revealed last week?
Yeah, right. I mean, I think that it's completely clear. I mean, if you got an email saying time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee, you wouldn't know what that meant. So it's completely clear that before that email, there had been some kind of communication between Bridget Ann Kelly and David Wildstein in which they discussed something. So a text message of such brevity would be completely clear. And I think one of the things that's very interesting about these documents is that there is an awful lot in the documents, but then there's clearly a lot of phone conversations taking place. For example, after Pat Foy sent out his famous email saying crimes have been committed, Bill Baroni then emailed the chair of the Port Authority, David Sampson, saying, General, can I call you now? And by the way, this general thing comes from the fact that Sampson had been the attorney general for the state of New Jersey. And we now know that David Sampson's response was to criticize Pat Foy for leaking it, not the document show to order an investigation.
So did they subpoena any of Christie's own documents if they didn't subpoena the governor himself, like his emails or anything like that?
The campaign was subpoenaed. So it's possible, I mean, just as the first five people caught a whole other web of emails in them, that this group of 20 is going to capture a whole lot more communications.
So communications that could include text or emails from the governor himself.
Right. I mean, I think another important question to ask is if this set of emails doesn't say Chris Christie ordered the lane closures, and I would frankly be shocked if such a email existed, at what point does he bear responsibility for the organization around him that felt empowered to do this?
Which is a political more than a legal question. Did he create a tone? Did he create an environment where people thought this was the kind of thing that he would like them to do on his behalf?
Or even more, what is the accountability that he has for his political staff and his gubernatorial staff?
If they do subpoena Christie documents, or if any of these from the campaign, as you say, include things that he actually emailed himself, and he resists citing executive privilege, complying with a subpoena, that's what people say could set off a state constitutional crisis that might have to be dealt with in court. How likely do you think that is?
Maybe I'm going to give you a political answer, which is I don't want to answer a question that hypothetical. I would like to I'll be watching, as will all of us, to see how that plays out.
Andrea Bernstein, WNYC Metro editor, as we talk about the developments in Bridgegate today, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Martin in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, this is exciting. I love your coverage. It's fascinating. It reminds me, the focus on the bridge closing, though, I view the bridge closing as kind of a tip of the iceberg thing, just like the Watergate break-in was a tip of the iceberg, which ultimately revealed the obnoxious enemies list. And it seems to me that the whole Christie organization worked off that same wonderful Richard Nixon philosophy that nothing should stand in the way of my power and my way of doing things.
There is certainly ample evidence of that. In fact, just one small example. In the story that I did today on a broad look at how the Christie team used the Port Authority to benefit Chris Christie politically, there's a clip of Bill Baroni, who was testifying before the U.S. Senate. Senator Frank Lautenberg was having an inquiry into the toll increases, and he was asking various questions about the Port Authority. And Bill Baroni showed up with a big binder full of apparently dirt on Senator Frank Lautenberg, and at various times when Frank Lautenberg got close to embarrassing the Port Authority, Bill Baroni would refer to it and mention something like, oh, Senator Lautenberg, you were a Port Authority commissioner. You were able to not pay your tolls, I think it was 274 times, although I wouldn't swear to that number. But there was that kind of thing where they sort of were unafraid to publicly, in a U.S. Senate hearing, embarrass their testimony, their enemies. And by all accounts, it was even more aggressive internally. There were cases where people were fired from the Port Authority. There's a case that had – there was a lot of reporting around it where the cousin of the former Democratic governor, Dick Cody, was fired from the Port Authority after Cody said something that insulted Christie. And not only was he fired, but embarrassing information about his past, when he'd been having trouble as an alcoholic and had been harassing a young man, all of that was released to the press immediately after he was fired. So it was sort of like Stalin's henchmen tracking Trotsky down to the ends of the earth. I mean, it wasn't just enough that he leave the agency.
Martin, thank you for your call. And he brought up Watergate analogies. I've been a little surprised to hear two classic Watergate-related Nixonisms come out of the mouth of the politically adept Chris Christie. Here they are. This was right at the top of the State Address this week.
Mistakes were clearly made.
Mistakes were made, which Nixon's press secretary famously said and got derided forever for putting it in the passive voice. Mistakes were made, as if the mistakes made themselves, not taking responsibility. Is Chris Christie usually so adept? With Chris Christie, who's usually so adept with language, stumbling here? Is he stumbling here with Nixon times two?
Well, you know, it's hard to speculate what – I mean, that obviously was not written off the cuff. I mean, the one that caught my attention was in the press conference of last week where he said, I am not a bully.
Wait a minute. You mean this?
I am not a bully.
Recalling I am not a crook, the
right.
Denial that becomes an acknowledgement of the suspicion.
Right. Exactly. And, something that you sort of have to live down for the rest of your career. That press conference, interestingly, was – I'm pretty sure it was on Richard Nixon's birthday, January 9th.
Oh.
I think that
coincidence.
Yes, there is this question about, you know, why he phrases things this way. But, you know, a lot of this is inexplicable. I mean, I think for those of us who have watched Chris Christie, who have felt that he's been very gifted in the way he articulates things, very much so in the way he relates to people, people still feel strongly about him. I mean, I spoke to people this week, some Democratic mayors who'd endorsed him, and they still felt very passionately. They were, this is the man that saved us from Sandy. And there's almost this sort of kind of imprint that happens, like with the doctor that saved your life. Like, the people feel so grateful and so strongly about him that a lot of this stuff doesn't seem to be punching through.
And
so,
his popularity ratings in the polls haven't taken much of a hit yet. John in Point Pleasant Beach, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Yes, thanks. What I wanted to comment on was, I think eventually Christie, although he's engaged to Randy Mastro, who's notoriously aggressive, but eventually, he's going to want to start, and I think his nature is that he's going to be, start to respond aggressively. I don't know how long he can keep himself sort of in the low-key manner, especially with things like his attorney general nominee pending. And he usually just doesn't sit there and let that happen without commenting on it. But he's kind of boxed in on how he reacts because, then it gets back to reinforcing that image.
Right. It's a great strategic point that I guess he and his new task force appointee, Randy Mastro, are going to have to figure out how much do we try to bash back and resist subpoenas, and how much does that defeat us, and so we just go ahead and cooperate, right?
Yeah, I mean, Randy Mastro is such an interesting character to be brought in here. He's described as sort of a former aide to Rudy Giuliani, but that doesn't quite get to it. I mean, he
was chief of staff at the beginning of the Giuliani administration, right?
He worked with Giuliani when Giuliani was in the federal prosecutor's office. And, unlike Chris Christie, as a federal prosecutor, Giuliani really became famous, and particularly in his prosecutions of New York City corruption cases. And Randy Mastro was involved in that. But then when they went to the mayor's office, Randy Mastro was just this close to Rudy Giuliani. There was a group of them that used to watch The Godfather together. They referred to themselves as La Familia. I remember seeing them all in, bizarrely, I think it was the Hard Rock Cafe Hotel the night before the Florida primary where Giuliani left. And Randy Mastro and a number of Giuliani's top aides were there, and they were eating steak, and I want to say they were smoking cigars, but I wouldn't swear to it.
So they were just this very tight,
very, very tight
group.
Loyal bunch.
Right. But to be fair, on the Godfather reference, maybe that's how they refer to it, but just to be fair and cite history, Giuliani rose to prominence to some degree by prosecuting Italian mob figures.
Absolutely, absolutely. So there was a sort of, I mean, there was the irony in that, that they, you know, used to get together at Gracie Mansion and watch The Godfather.
As did Christie by prosecuting both Democratic and Republican politicians for corruption when he was U.S. attorney. Roseanne in Bernardsville, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. As I listened to your news reports on this last night, I couldn't help but say, really? Christie has hired his own person to come in and investigate or advise him. And my question is, are the taxpayers of New Jersey paying for this? It sounds like we have three separate investigations going on right now. And the appointment by Christie sounds like he's hired someone to represent his own interests and that it's rather partisan and that we as the taxpayers, do we pay for that?
Great question. Who's paying Randy Mastro?
I don't know the answer, but I'd like to find out.
Well, we will have to get that answer because that's a really great question. Janet in South Plainfield, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. There's a really big irony in this, in that when Chris Christie was first elected, he gave away New Jersey Network and the 120 employees, including tons of local reporters, that would have kept his behavior in check. And he did that, I believe, because Zachary Fink broke two unflattering stories about him during the campaign, one about getting stopped going the wrong way down a one-way street and basically telling the cop, don't you know who I am?
Well, we should say, though.
And the other about the loan to one of his aides that he failed to report. Failed to report interest on. And without local reporting, nobody knows what's going on. Of course, people still love him. Who wants to be a YouTube video of somebody who asked them a question he doesn't like in a town hall?
Janet, thank you. I should say that Zach Fink landed well at New York One and that New Jersey Public Television, the old NJN, is now part of Channel 13, and they go on. And he also sold the old NJN radio as part of that, in part to WNYC, which now runs it as New Jersey Public Radio, as many of you know, which has done a lot of the toughest investigative reporting on Bridgegate with Matt Katz and Nancy Solomon and Sarah Gonzalez all out there on the beat. So we should say that whatever he did with public broadcasting, I don't think it wound up calling off the dogs on Chris Christie.
Yeah, I mean, I will also say that corruption happened before that. I mean, there have been a lot of problems in Drumthwacket prior to the selling of the television and radio.
To finish up, Seth on our webpage asks, will this be like Whitewater? It starts out as one thing but ends as another. In this case, uncovering the wild abuses of the Port Authority. So that brings us back to your piece today, which is about Christie using the Port Authority as, what do you say, a political piggy bank?
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is something that we've talked about and that I've covered, the way in which the governors of New York and New Jersey have over the years used the Port Authority. And I think what is so striking about Christie is the way he was so organized and aggressive. And David Wildstein was the director of Interstate Capital Projects. That means he was in charge of all the big money deals. And who cares about those deals? Mayors, unions, Democrats, people that Christie needed the support of. And he, I wouldn't commend them to listen to the story because I think that the tape really tells the tale. But really, very, very systematically, from the get-go, he identified the Port Authority as a place where there was a lot of money. And this was very important to a fiscal conservative who vowed to cut budgets and not raise taxes. And it solved a lot of his budget problems in this sort of off-the-books way and allowed him to continue his narrative of, I'm a fiscally conservative Republican, I'm not going to cut taxes, and I can work with unions and Democrats. And yes, he could work with unions and Democrats because there was this big pot of money that they were sort of using off to the side to advance some goals. Now, what they point out is we were just aggressively working on projects that helped the state of New Jersey. But there have been a number of questions raised about whether those were appropriate Port Authority-funded projects, whether the funding should have come from the Port District rather than the state of New Jersey itself.
WNYC Metro Editor Andrea Bernstein, working with the New Jersey Public Radio team, covering Bridgegate. Andrea, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC Congressman Keith Ellison next. Stay with us.